Greetings and salutations. My name is Tyler Elenick, and this is Raven Drool, the podcast that chronicles all things 90s can rock. In this episode, I speak with Lonnie James, who was part of many a band in the 90s, including The Lawn, The Nils, The Super Friends, and he also managed to release two pretty killer solo records in the decade as well. Hope you dig our chat. Your timeline's a bit fuzzy for me in the 90s or in your career, but you ended up in the Super Friends in, I think, 96.
Yes, I believe that's a good guess.
Excellent. So what was your journey from, say, 90 to 96? What were you kind of up to musically? Who were you playing with? Where were you playing?
Well, I was living in Toronto, and by that point, you know, I was a pretty busy local drummer guy that played with a lot of bands. You know, sometimes you just do one gig, you know, for, you know, $50, so you do a couple rehearsals and one gig, or sometimes I'd be in other bands, and there was times when I was in, like, you know, four or five bands around, you know, through that decade, right? And Toronto, at that point, there was only, like, you know, three or four drummers that were kind of doing everything. You know, there was, like, you know, there was Glenn Milcham, there was Rustin Baldwin, there was me, but there was a small club of guys who were pretty much almost doing everything, you know. So I was like that. So around that time, I was pretty busy with a lot of local stuff as well, like those bands like Yeti and Naugahyde Five, and then Daisy and the Super Jeans, stuff like that. And it was almost every weekend around that time. You know, I was a pretty busy guy. It would be like on a Friday night or a Saturday night, I'd be in a band, you know, opening at one club, and then I'd, like, load my drums in after the set and then go to another club and play in the band that was headlining or in the middle act or whatever, stuff like that. And, you know, that was my life for a long time in Toronto. So I was a pretty busy local guy, and I also worked at La Hacienda through that time. I washed dishes and was a bartender and occasionally waited tables when need be. So through that, Hacienda was kind of like a cultural hub. I'm not sure if you were ever there or you know of the place, but it is a bar and restaurant on Queen Street that was like a gathering place for culture, for movie people, for artists, for fashion people, and for punk rockers. It was a gathering for kind of like the punk or an underground scene for a long time. So my involvement working there, they put me in contact with, like, every touring band from Vancouver to Calgary, Saskatoon. They all came to Hacienda for burritos. You know what I mean? It was like a place like that. I mean, like, you know, the Ramones came with us, Sonic Keith, you know, all these people. You could go on and on, Marilyn Manson. But, you know, but pretty much every band that was on tour in Canada for, you know, those 10 years, I served them, or I was there, because I lived upstairs as well for a long time on the third floor in an apartment they had up there. So what I'm saying is that I was in contact with pretty much everybody in, you know, in the music industry in Canada at that time, whether it's just serving them a beer or, you know, having a smoke with them or something, or being their friends and, you know, whatever. So I was pretty fortunate in that way. And I'm from Calgary originally, but, you know, through the course of my life until now, I've lived in Halifax, I've lived in Toronto, I've lived in Montreal, and I played music in all these cities. The reason I lived in all these cities is because I played music. So I've been very fortunate. The experiences that I had and the people that I've worked with through my life, I feel very fortunate, and I'm still playing. I'm still active, you know what I mean? I just have a new record out of my own stuff, and I still play drums in bands, you know? So life's been pretty good. But going back to the thing there, it was like, you know, like The Lawn, you know, is a good place to start, because we were actually signed on a label, and you can hear that stuff on Spotify. And they were around before I joined. I was the second drummer, and there was just, you know, like Now Magazine in Toronto is the weekly, you know, music culture paper that comes out. And I just remember opening it up, and it said, this week, you know, the Lawn are playing at the Rivoli, and, you know, I read the little blurb that went with the ad, and it said they were looking for a drummer, Mike Bush. Like, I know all these people, so that's why I can say them by their names. I just know them. And that he was quitting and they're looking for a drummer. I said, man, I love those guys. Like, I don't know if you've heard their first record. It's just called The Lawn. It was a very small release. Not a lot of, I don't know how many copies went out, but all the covers were individually done by Ward, you know, the singer, main guy. So they're all different, and there wasn't a lot of them. I have one, that a cover that he made. It's kind of artsy, whatever. And then another one I have he gave me later when I was in the band. It's just blank, a white cover. But if you ever get a chance to hear that, Robert, it's freaking amazing. Huh. It's so cool. It's a cool little kind of like, it's hard to describe the sound, but you just have to hear it. But it's pretty unique. And they were a pretty special band in Toronto. And Gord Cumming, the main guy, he's like a Toronto treasure. He should be huge. And he knows everybody. And, you know, if he actually puts his mind to it, you know, he can get 300 people out to a show. You know what I mean? He's one of those guys. He's everybody's friend. And I was in a band with him. And, you know, he's just one of those guys that he's just so good with people. You know what I mean? And which is a good attribute for a lead singer, right?
Absolutely.
You know, you can make people feel good. And, you know, I witnessed many times, you know, he would be in the middle of a, you know, a tense or uncomfortable social situation, and he would just say a few words and everybody would be okay. You know what I mean? One of those people.
Yeah.
You know, I like being around people like that. You know, it keeps you positive, you know, and it makes you realize that you shouldn't get too cynical, even though the music business is a, breed cynicism if you're in it long enough, you know what I mean? Like like I said before, I feel very fortunate that I'm actually still, you know, still playing. And, you know, because at my age, I'm a dinosaur in rock and roll years, you know, but it doesn't even matter anymore, you know? So I got some gas left in me.
Okay, so I was talking about The Lawn and when we got signed, and then the first time we went up to A&M Records, we had a friend of ours that worked for A&M, and he was our, you know, kind of thing in there. And, you know, and I remember going in there, and we were really high. And I just didn't even think about it. But then when we walked in the front doors, all of a sudden it was, like, really weird. All of a sudden I got really paranoid because I just thought, hey, we're in the big A&M Records, you know, we're rock and roll musicians, and we're stoned. This is great. This is, you know, this is my dream. But you go in there, and it was like a it was like a clinic or something. It was just like all of a sudden I felt really guilty that I was high. It was just like whatever. It was no big deal, but it just kind of made me laugh. You know what I mean? That I said, wow, like this is the reality of it, right? Like they don't want people jacking around in here, you know. You know, but we went in to get our work done and stuff. But you know, it was cool. I remember going in there, and they had in the front hallway they had one of a pool table that belonged to Charlie Chaplin.
Huh. Wow.
Because A&M is Herb Albert and Jerry Moss. They're from L.A., and that's where the big A&M is, so that's probably where the Charlie Chaplin piano came from. Well, you know, whatever. But, you know, it was cool. It was all a good experience, you know. And, you know, the thing with The Lawn, we put out the record, and we went on tour. We went on tour across Canada with 13 Engines.
Oh, wow.
Who were big at the time. I can't remember the name of the record that was out when it was like the double album. Do you remember them?
I do, yeah. Perpetual Motion Machine and Conquistador, I think, was another record.
Conquistador. Right? That's the tour we did with them. It was The Lawn. I mean, we were friends with theirs, so it just made sense. We do have a lot of fun, but The Lawn were kind of like, we kind of came apart at the seams by the end of the tour. You know what I mean? It was like, like I said, all these guys are still my friends, and I have total respect for them. And there was really nothing bad that happened. It just, not everyone's cut out for touring, you know?
Right.
Like, I found that in my life. I've been a good pirate, man. I've been everywhere, you know what I mean? My rock and roll life has taken me all over America and Canada and into the UK and Europe, you know, in my life. And I'd go on tour tomorrow if I was called, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I love it, but I know it's not for everybody. I've seen a lot of guys kind of either go crazy or just like quit or walk away or, you know, do whatever, you know what I mean? Cause it's just not for everybody. It's a tough grind because, you know, everyone thinks it's glamorous. You know what I mean? I remember, you know, being in the Super Friends, and you know, pretty lucky in the Super Friends. We were, you know, medium level kind of indie. You know, we weren't, when we went on tour, you know, we got like, you know, $30 per diems instead of 10. You know what I mean? We weren't starving. You know, you could save up your per diems and still eat, because when we got to the gig, there was food there for us, which is when you're down a couple notches before that, you don't get that. You know, you get your $5 per diem and you go to McDonald's and you know, you share whatever you can. You know what I mean? You get by, or you buy sandwiches. So, you know, I really do feel fortunate that, you know, I've been able to, you know, keep going. You know what I mean? Because I've seen a lot of guys jump off. You know what I mean? Or they just say, I can't do this, or they get married. You know what I mean? People grow up, you know what I mean? And, you know, and then people like me don't, you know what I mean? I've been fighting growing up my entire life. Right. So I don't have to act like an adult too often, you know, but even though I am.
Before we move off the lawn, is there a track or something off that album that you'd like people to hear that you're really proud of?
Yeah. That was good. One of my picks. It's called Catwalk Slip.
And what do you remember about writing or recording that song with the guys?
Well, that was like, we did that with Tom Tremouth. Like I said, he was Hypnotic Records, and that's one of the tracks. They had already started the record with their previous drummer, so it's like that first record is called Debussy Fields. Like, it's a play on the composer Claude Debussy.
Right.
And Debussy Fields, so it's called Debussy Fields. And it's a pretty good record, but I can't remember the other drummer's name. I feel really bad. But He plays on like four or five of the songs, and I play on four or five. I can't remember. It's listed on the tracks. So I came in when they were halfway through the record.
Mm.
But a lot of things I remember about that is that it was Tom Tremouth who owned the label, and he produced that record. And that was a pretty big change for The Lawn, because Tom Tremouth, he was known in the industry. He produced Anvil, the metal band that still plays whatever. So his production was like really loud and rock and for lack of a better word, like corporate sounding, compared, you know, to The Lawn, which was like really more in the lines of like Pere Ubu kind of, you know, sounding sonically. It's hard to describe. You'd have to hear it. So a lot of people, you know, thought in the community thought, oh, that's kind of an odd pairing. Because The Lawn weren't known as like a big industry band, but Tremouth was a good guy. But his mixing style was like really fucking loud. Like, it was unbearable to sit, you know, at points in the control room with him, because he would listen from the first time through to the end of the day, like every playback you heard. And I don't know if you've ever been involved in making a record. You have to hear these songs hundreds of times, you know, to get to the finished, you know, point.
Yeah.
And he used to listen to it at like ear shattering volume. And at points, even for me, who, you know, is an old dog, you know, it was hard to take. So I remember that, you know, but I mean, it was a cool room. It was a nice room to play in. And I think the record's pretty good. It's not necessarily, if you talk to people in Toronto who are like hardcore Lawn fans, they prefer the first album over the second one, as do I. You know, if you look at it as you know, what the Lawn were to these people. But when I look at Debussy Fields, that was kind of, the Lawn were kind of trying to evolve, but hadn't yet got to where they were going. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it would have taken another album or two before I think they, you know, we came into something what we were supposed to be then. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard, you know, in music, because like the Lawn is a good example, because they were local boys, and they have like a good following, you know, of hardcore local people that were fans. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And people talk very fondly of them, and they were very unique. Like I said, if you hear that record, you'll understand what I mean. It's so cool and so one of a kind. That it's almost impossible to recreate that a second time, especially with a different drummer and 2 years later. You know what I mean? Like, because, you know, those guys are musicians, and as a musician, you evolve. You don't stay the same your whole career. That's boring. You know what I mean?
Right.
But the irony of that is that's what fans want. You know, like there's bands like The Who, and there's stories from them. Like, you know, they had to play the same set for so many years, like for over 10 years, the set they played, because of all their huge hits,
right.
it was almost exactly the same, to the point where Keith Moon had a special drum set made with the set list on the finish of the drums, so he could just, it would be there.
Wow.
You know, that's how much they played the songs, the same thing. So, yeah, but people want that, right? They don't want to always hear new stuff from artists, right? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and if they get into the new stuff, it might take a couple of years, you know, before that stuff becomes what they want to hear, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, The Lawn, we went on tour, and I don't know what happened. It's just like the band kind of unraveled a little bit, not musically, but more personally. And I can't remember if we broke up right after that or we just didn't play anymore. You know, I ended up playing with Gord in a couple local bands around, like one called Possum. And we recorded a couple songs, so there's no animosity or anything. Like I'm telling these stories. You know, stuff happens. You know, but you know, they're my friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we still like each other.
So after The Lawn kind of ended, what was the kind of next move for you? Just to find another group to play with, or going back to being kind of like a session guy in a way?
Well, I always, you know, kind of did the session thing because that always brought you a little bit of extra pocket money. But yeah, no, I was always looking for a group. You know, I was very driven, you know, and after that, I started playing with the Nils, I believe.
Hmm.
So then I went to Montreal for a little bit, and those guys were great. I mean, I don't know if you must be familiar with the Nils,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, they had a whole thing before me, you know what I mean? I don't claim to I don't claim to be. You know, their best days were before I joined, so I'm not saying, hey, I was a superstar in, you know, Nils or whatever. But I remember, I know James McLean. He was a friend of mine from London, Ontario, I met just through the scene. He used to book like the Embassy there. He used to go and play at his club, and then he'd put you up at his place, you know, until you'd leave the next day. And that's how I met him. And then he was in Montreal, and he eventually became a manager for the Doughboys, and he ran like an agency. He managed other bands and stuff. So he started helping the Nils, who were trying to resurrect their, you know, career again, whatever. And he just phoned me, I just saw him one day, and, you know, at his office. I used to go in there and deal with some other people around there, and he just said, "Oh, the Nils are looking for a drummer, man. You want to do it?" And I said, "Well." I said, "Man, how can I not? I mean, I love those songs. You know what I mean? Like, that's a great record, you know, the LP that they put out." And I said, "Sure." So I went out there, and basically what happened is I ended up being with the band for about a year. I went there, and I lived with Alex and his wife, Karen, or his girlfriend. And we did a tour. We played a few times in Montreal, but we did a Canadian tour. And then we went down to New York, and we recorded like, I think maybe 7 songs with this guy, Phil Burnett, who that they knew from before. And he was a guy, he worked with like Bad Brains and bands like that down there. And he basically paid for us to come down there.
Wow.
And we went into a recording studio there. We went into the studio in New York City was owned by one of the guys from 10cc. Huh. You know, I can't remember his fucking name, and I don't even care. But so it was big time stuff. This guy, you know, bought us a week in there, and I think it was like late sessions, so they were cheaper. But yeah, we went in and recorded a bunch of songs, and then they even bounced us one day out of there because Keith Richards was coming in.
No way.
So we had to get all our shit out for one day. But they said we could kind of hang around a little bit, but until, you know, Keith comes and they start working, then we'd have to leave. But so basically what happened, I was amazed. So this is Keith Richards was coming in to lay down guitar on someone's record or something. And so basically what happened was about an hour and a half before Keith came in, 5 people that worked for him came in and they set everything up. There was like a guy setting up his amp, his guitar. There was people setting up his food, his booze, his smokes, the whole thing, making sure it was ready for him when he came in. It was unbelievable to watch this.
Wow.
And then fucking he comes in, we have to leave. But everything was basically like set up for him. Packs of smokes waiting. You know what I mean? And then the next day, you know, we got back in there and, you know, resumed our recording. But it was just, you know, wow, man. You know, you think you're a rock star. You know, you go, no, this guy is.
Yeah, that's a whole other level right there. Yeah.
You just even have to buy smokes. You know what I mean? Like,
that's awesome.
But whatever. Yeah, so we recorded. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. But, I mean, you know, the Nils, you know, that was a... You know, that's a bit of a tragic story, too, because Alex ended up, you know, committing suicide. And, the two of the guys that I was in the band with at the time, Sanjay, the one guitar player, and then Alex, you know, are dead now, right? And I remember, I mean, like I said, again, I'm speaking of all this, like, I love all these people, right? You know what I mean? Like, they're my friends, and Alex I miss dearly. And, you know, but the truth is, you know, he was a heroin addict, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he was for a long time. And I'm not judging anyone, right? Like, that was his choice. And he was dealing with that for a long time. And then, like, he died after the Nils split. But I remember being, like, he had a band called Chino that he formed after the Nils with a couple other guys from Montreal. And they were really good. They even put out a record, I believe. And they came to Toronto a few times, and I was in a one band one time, and we opened for him.
Huh.
I think it was Yeti. We opened for Chino, and it was great. Good to see Alex, and I got a chance to talk with him a bit in the alley. It was behind Lee's Palace, and he was clean at that point, and he was here for about a year. And I go, man, that's so good, Alex. Fuck, that's so good.
Yeah.
You know, and he seemed to be getting back on the track. He said he didn't, you know, want to do that anymore and all this, and he had a really good band. And then, I don't know, it was some time after that.
Wow.
I remember going to see a comedian, and they had I was waiting for my girlfriend outside of the washroom, and there was just like a newspaper there, Globe and Mail, and I picked it up, and I just was flipping through it, and it was like a half-page obituary of Alex, and he walked in front of a train, right?
Jeez.
And I know he was probably depressed, and he was, you know, he was an addict for like 10 years, you know what I mean? And that, yeah, I've known a lot of people just through my life that have been involved in drugs like that for various times. And if you're addicted to heroin for like 10 years, it's really hard to get off. And B, if you do kick it, it's with you for a long time. Just that feeling, you know what I mean? Mm. So I know he was dealing with stuff like that. And eventually he just walked in front of a train, you know, and it made me so sad for a while, you know, to
Absolutely.
Know that he's gone, but you know, what are you going to do? Right. Like, and then Sanjay, you know, that's another sad story too, because through Carlos, who was Alex's brother and the bass player in the band, Carlos plays guitar on their album. But by the time I played with them, Carlos was on bass and Alex was on guitar and singing, and they had this young guy, Sanjay, on guitar, and he was so cool. I mean, I feel so bad. He was like 21 years old or whatever, and he idolized Alex. And he was the guitar player in the band when I joined, and he was just this young guy, and he was the rhythm guitar player. And unfortunately, Alex used to like and Carlos, they kind of used to treat him like shit in the band. And like I said, no disrespect to any of these people, but this was just my experience, right?
Right, exactly.
And the Nils was a strange band to be in. You know, I jumped in a lot of vans with a lot of people that I didn't really know that well, and the Nils was one of them. And but the thing is with Sanjay is like he was 21. He idolized Alex, and he was playing in the Nils. He just would do anything. He was like a little puppy kind of guy. And those guys really took advantage of the kid. They treated him like a dog kind of, you know what I mean? And I used to kind of get frustrated, but what do you do, you know? And what happened was at the end of the day is because like Alex was, you know, addicted, and so was his brother Carlos. And like I said, I don't mean to speak badly of people. I like these people. And Carlos got Sanjay hooked on heroin by snorting what he told him was cocaine,
no, wow.
But it was heroin. And Sanjay, you know, he's whatever doing with it, and then he gets hooked. So here's little Sanjay. He's bent out of shape on heroin, living with his girlfriend, and she was hooked too, because that's what happens. And they started selling it.
Wow.
And they got into debt with some dealer for like $50,000 or something, because they ended up doing all their stash, which
oh,
they
wow.
should have been selling.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, this guy was after Sanjay for like a lot of money for drugs. So what Sanjay does, and remind you, like he's 21. So he's East Indian, and he goes back to India to live with his grandmother. His girlfriend, I don't know where she went to. I've never heard of her again. But he went off to India to hide out at his grandmother's house, and he ended up ODing at his grandmother's house.
Wow.
And, you know, there's the end of that story. And then there's Carlos, who was the bass player, who was kind of all bent out of shape, too. And the last time I saw him, it was kind of sad. He was like, I don't know if he was like living on the street or like one step away from it, but he sure looked like it. It was like I was playing with Royal City, and we had just come back from Europe. We played in Europe. We were there for a month. UK and Europe, we played 29 gigs in 28 days.
Wow.
And we came back, and we had to play Montreal, and then we were going home, and I was fucking exhausted. But I remember going for dinner in Montreal. We had set up, we did sound check, and I was really exhausted. And I just, when I go on tour, after a while, I'm not scared. You just got to get away. You just got to just go, okay, walk away from everybody for a while. Go buy a record or sit in a park by yourself. I'm never scared of doing that. So I decided I got to go get something to eat, and I just went by myself. So I went to this burrito joint that was close to the place we were playing that I used to go to, and I was waiting for a light to cross, and I just hear, "Hey, Lonnie," and then someone taps on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's Carlos.
Hmm.
And he had on that same old Montreal Canadiens parka that he used to have, and in some pants, and he was like filthy. You know, like street people are like, their clothes are just covered in dirt,
yeah.
And it's the same color as their skin. That's all. That's what he was.
Wow.
And I was like, inside, I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
you know, what do I say? You know what I mean? To my friend, he goes, how you doing? I said, oh, I'm okay. And I didn't want to tell him I just came home from a European tour and all of this. And so what he was up to, like I said, he was kind of, he was hooked on heroin too. And what he was doing at that time, and like I said, Montreal is a small town, right? And everybody knows everybody in the Little Rock world. And what he was doing was he would go into like a bar or a restaurant, and he would like go in the washroom and start a fire in the waste bin or something, and then come out going, there's a fire, there's a fire. And then when the people that worked there would run in there to deal with it, he would rob the till for money to support his habit. Like, this is where he was, right? And I just knew this because, you know, people, it's a small town, like I said, everybody knew what he was doing. You know, he'd do this in bars where he knew the people that worked there. You know, because when you're an addict, you steal from your friends.
Yeah.
You know, that's another thing, too, with the Nils. Like, as much as I love those guys, when we went on tour across Canada to Vancouver and back, we stayed at a lot of places that people that I knew, because I had already done a lot of touring, and I knew people in every town where you could, if you needed a couch, you could crash on a couch.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the Nils to all these places, and I didn't even, you know, think about it or hear or anything. And then on the next tour, when I remember being with the Super Friends, touring across in all the same cities and meeting all my same friends, and then all of a sudden they're telling me, oh, you know that band you were with here last time? You know, they stole a bunch of CDs from my house.
Wow.
You know, and they knew me. They go, I know it's not you because, you know, I know you, Lonnie. And I said, oh, fuck. You know, like, Jesus Christ, man. And, you know, again, like I said, I love these guys. You know what I mean? But this is, you know, these are the stories that happens to rock bands on the road, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it worked out okay that most of these people, like I said, they knew me and they knew it wasn't me.
Right.
You know, but like I said, you know, Canada is a small music community. You know what I mean? Like, you know everybody. You know, if you tour a few times, you know, and you play enough gigs or you go to enough gigs, you know everybody.
Exactly.
And it's just like everything else in life, man. You got to keep your ass clean, you know, no matter where you are, because that it will always get back through somebody somehow. Somebody's sister will see you somewhere, and you know what I mean? That's how life works.
Just to kind of wrap up the Nils chapter in your life, just as a fan of the band, you know, what's your favorite, you know, how would you introduce the Nils to somebody who's not aware of them?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what year it is, but the record Sell Out Young.
Yeah.
You know that little EP?
Right.
That's where I would start. That's my favorite Nils record of all time. Sell Out Young. And then I love the LP too. You know what I mean? To me, that's all you need. And I remember Alex, he gave me, I don't know if you're aware, there's another little EP called the Paisley EP. It's came out before Sell Out Young. It's pretty rare, I guess. Alex gave me a copy. I didn't even know it existed. And I'm a record guy. I've got thousands and thousands of records. I collect records my whole life. And I remember being in the band and sitting in Alex's living room, and he just goes to a cupboard one day and he pulls this Paisley EP. He goes, I still got a few of these. I guess you can have one since you're in the band. I said, holy shit, man, that's amazing. Fuck, great. You know what I mean? It was like a holy grail almost for me. You know what I mean? I hadn't even heard of it, you know, before that. So, and to be brutally honest, I listened to it once, but I couldn't recall anything off it. So, like I said, I'll choose the Sell Out Young EP because I love that one.
Perfect.
And I actually still, that song In Betweens that's on that record, I still play that in my solo set or with my group now. I still play that every once in a while because I love that song. let me finish with the Nils. We were on tour, and it was funny because, like I said, you know, our manager or the guy that was helping us was James McLean,
nice.
Who's the manager of the Doughboys.
Yeah.
So through him, when we went on tour with the Nils, and like I said, we were hardly, I can't even know how much we were getting paid. You know, I didn't see any money from the tour, you know what I mean? Like, so it wasn't a lot of money. But we had a van through James McLean that the Doughboys used to use, but it was a rental. But it had like a TV, you know, with an aerial on top, a DVD, like CD player, speakers, these deluxe captain's chairs. So we were like watching movies and everything the whole way. But I remember like we were getting flack like from a lot of these bands and people that, you know, we'd pull up and, you know, people would see we'd get out and there's, you know, watching, you know, Reservoir Dogs and captain's chairs in the back of this van, and people go, oh, Nils, the fucking, what, they think they're rock stars or all this, like, it was funny, people would give us flack, and, you know, I try to explain to people, like, I don't even know how we're going to pay for this, like, to this day, I don't even know how that got paid for, because we ended up, Carlos ended up backing up into a pole in Vancouver and smashing one of the back windows. And we had jerry-rigged a new window with just some plywood that we painted black. And I wasn't even there, man. I was in Toronto when they had to take the thing back to the parking lot. They just dropped it off in the parking lot with the keys in it. And I don't know what happened, but I remember we made it to Vancouver and we were playing at this booze can. And it was funny because it ended up being like 3:30 or 4 in the morning, and you're sitting there and you're waiting to play. And, you know, I remember it was just like Chicks Dig It was there, and there was some kerfuffle. Like, I only heard about it later, but there was some kerfuffle between Carlos from the Nils and KJ, yeah. But there was some kerfuffle as to who was going to go on before the other one, because at this point, everyone was just desperate to go on because it was so freaking late. But it was this booze can in Vancouver, and I was somewhere else. And then I show up, and when we're supposed to play or something like that, and I was just talking with KJ. I ran into him, and and he was saying, oh, geez, that Carlos guy's a real fucking asshole. And I said, yeah, you should ride in the van. You don't have to ride in the van with him every day. But then he started telling me the story. He almost got in a fight with Carlos because we were supposed to go on, and Chicks Dig It just jumped up there, and they started getting set, and they kind of just usurped the spot.
Huh.
And like I said, I was in another building, or I was somewhere else. And apparently, KJ and Carlos like almost came to fisticuffs, probably more on Carlos's side than KJ, because I can't see KJ fist fighting. But there was some really bad kerfuffle. And years later, you know, when I was back in Calgary here, I remember running into KJ on the street, and we had a laugh over that, over Carlos. But, you know, so there's that. And, you know, those guys were like, you know, pretty sketchy. You know what I mean? They were like, they were buying all kinds of stuff at 7-Elevens or gas stations in the middle of the night with money from the gig, you know, and me and Sanjay weren't seeing any of that.
Wow.
You know, but yeah. But there was a hierarchy, there was a levels in the Nils, and I was on the bottom level, because riding in the van with them on tour was like Carlos and Alex, the two brothers. They were Spanish and they were French. And then Sanjay was just French-Canadian, and I was just an Anglais. So what would happen in the van is that when there were some things that they didn't want me to hear about, they would all speak in French, so I couldn't understand what they were saying. But then when there were things that the two brothers just wanted to talk about, they'd speak Spanish so that neither Sanjay or me could understand. So you knew when they were speaking Spanish, it was usually up to no good. So it was a really weird dynamic for the band. You know what I mean? And I remember, you know, when I just got back from the tour, and I remember we went back to Montreal, and what it was just a lot of sitting around doing nothing. Because, I mean, Alex, like I said, him and his wife were using, and he had a job, and so did she. You know, so they were functioning junkies. And he was just happy to go to work every day and come home and just get high and do nothing really. I remember being there for months at a time. You know, I had a girlfriend in Toronto. I had a life in Toronto. I was just kind of living at Alex's house. And I kept going, well, we're going to practice tonight. You know, we're going to do a gig this week. We're going to practice. And it was like for months, nothing. And I just said, I mean, I can't do this. And I went to James, you know, who was our manager. And I said, man, you know, like, well, these guys are just junkies, man. I can't sit around and do nothing. I got to go back to Toronto. You know, I got to play. You know, I want to see my girlfriend, you know. And I, if we were playing, it'd be fine. You know what I mean? If we were going on tour or recording, I'd be there. But, you know, so that was kind of the end. And then, you know, because I kind of talked to James about that, and James McClain was kind of the guy. He was very non-confrontational, and I you know, it was kind of everybody in Montreal kind of knew Alex was a junkie, but no one really said anything. You know, and when I went to James saying, "Fuck, you know, the guy's a junkie, man. Like, what are you gonna do? Like, you know, if we were doing shit, I don't care. You know, as long as you can be there, I don't care what a guy does. You can inject LSD right into your eyeball as long as you can make the gig. You know, I'm not going to complain." But there was no gig and no practice, so I said, man, I got to leave. So I kind of confronted everybody about that, and Alex kind of got a little mad at me that, and I remember going to his place, and I had to get my sleeping bag and the few things that I had there when I was going back to Toronto, and he was mad at me. He goes, "You shouldn't have fucking told everybody I was a fucking junkie." And I said, "Man, like, everybody fucking knows, Alex. Like, you know, whatever. It wasn't me that told everybody about it." But, you know, he threw my shit at me out the door, and that was it for a while. But like I said, we eventually connected again when he was in Chino, and, you know, we had a few good chats, and I wished him well, and we left off as friends, because I got you know, nothing but respect for the guy, because, you know, I can say all this about the Nils, and I don't mean it in any negative way, because, like I said, I don't care what anyone does, you know, what puts into their body, as long as they can do the gig. But with Alex, man, that guy wrote so many good songs. You know, like, we'd go to practice, and he'd go, what do you want to play? And I'd be going, oh, my fucking God, he's asking me. So I'm rifling off all my favorite songs, and going, okay. You know, we'll try that one. And, you know, but the thing was with Alex, that he had a garbage bag full of, like, you know, crumpled up papers with lyrics, you know, in the rehearsal space. And they were all over the floor. You know, you could pick up, you know, like, you know, famous Nils song, you know, lyrics on the floor that we'd be walking. You know what I mean? Like, he had so many songs. You know what I mean? Like, and a lot of, to me, the best ones that he used to ask me about, you know, what to play, he wouldn't play them. Like I said, play in betweens. Let's play in betweens. Nah, he would never do that one. But like I said, man, I feel extremely grateful that I got a chance to play. And yeah, so pretty much after that, after the Nils, you know, split up, I think I went on to, like, the Super Friends.
Was the Hacienda the gateway to the Super Friends, or was that another relationship that you had?
How I got on to the Super Friends was through this guy named Clive McNutt. He was just a local guitar player who used to actually play with me when I did my solo stuff a lot in the early days. And he played on a couple of my early recordings, just because he was a buddy and he was a really good guitar player. And we used to have a lot of time to sit around. And but he was from Halifax, so he knew all those guys, all the Murphys and, you know, Al Tuck and everybody.
Yeah.
But he lived in Toronto and was my friend. So somehow he heard that the Super Friends were looking for a drummer, probably through Andrew Scott, who at the time lived in Toronto. He was the only guy from Sloan or any of those Halifax people at that point who lived in Toronto. So, yeah, I think through Andrew speaking with Clive, and then Clive, you know, hanging out with me, he said, yeah, they need a drummer. And then Clive recommended me. And then the next thing I knew, I was on the phone to Matt Murphy. And like a month and a half after that, I went out there and we rehearsed for like 10 days. And then we started on a tour, you know, which was kind of how my life went for a long time around, you know, the 90s, where I would just, like, join this band, rehearse twice, jump in the van, and go on tour. And I was like, hey, nice to meet you. Let's get to know each other, you know, in the harshest way possible.
If you could compare the Halifax scene once you got there to the Toronto music scene.
Oh, night and day. You know what I mean? Right? Like, the Toronto is the center of the music industry. So you get all the labels there, and you get all the label people there, and you know, it's a big city. It's you know, so you get all the weight that that carries too. So all the best of the best comes to play in Toronto. So there's that influence, right? And then you go to Halifax, and it's a small city, and there's no music industry there. So you all of a sudden you minus the competition. The elbowing your friends out of the way for the brass ring kind of attitude, right?
Right.
You know, which is in Toronto, and you know, which is neither good or bad, because in Toronto it's an industry town. Mm-hmm. Everybody there is trying to make it, and in a way that's good, because the level of bands there, like even to get to a shit level, you've got to be good. You can rule Regina, and you know, you still be kind of mediocre in Toronto because the level of expectation from other bands and from people and bar owners and bookers is a lot higher in Toronto. Cause like, yeah. Oh fuck. You know, we've seen that, man, dude, you gotta be better than that. You know, no more blues, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean, right?
Absolutely. No, absolutely.
So, but in Halifax it's an interesting kind of mix because you have an intense, there's a lot of very talented people there. You know what I mean? Like there's some great musicians and great bands in a really small place. Yet, there's no competition. You know, there's none of that. They're all friends. And everybody's welcoming, you know, male, female, you know, whatever gender or sexuality you choose to follow, it's all welcome. You know, there's no uptight. You know what I mean? Everyone is your friend unless you screw them around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that in turn breeds a very healthy and quite high quality or high level of music scene. You know what I mean? Like for a while there, Halifax was the spotlight of the world,
yeah.
Or at least North America, you know, for rock. So I had a lot of fun in Halifax and people are genuine there. You know what I mean? Like the fans that come out and the friends you make there, it's all genuine. Whereas in Toronto, a lot of people have an agenda. Mm. You know what I mean? You have a lot of acquaintances. Everybody gets along. You're even friends with a lot of people, but then there's the business. You know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So Halifax and that, but they both have produced, you know, more than their share of, you know, amazing, you know, talent.
Yeah.
You know, like when you talk about the Super Friends, you know, because you know, 20 years has passed since you know a Slideshow came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least maybe 22. I don't know. So you know, we've all had a lot of time to reflect on everything that's happened since then. And you know, when I think back, I feel so lucky again. I hate to keep coming back to that, but I am. I feel so fortunate that I played in the Super Friends because my opinion is, and again, no disrespect to any of these other people. It was that Matt Murphy was the most talented guy out of all of them, like Joel Plaskett,
wow.
Chris Murphy, all of those guys. Again, I love all of them, please. You know what I mean? Like, if they're listening out there, I have all their records, man. I like it all. But when you get down to just talking about reality, I think as a student of music, looking at it in an objective way, Matt Murphy was the most talented guy out of that whole bunch. So in turn, I go, man, I was so lucky. I'm glad I got a couple of years to play with those guys and tour around and make records and have a lot of fun, really, you know?
So how far or how soon after joining them did you start kind of writing and recording? Because you did an EP with them as well, like Play the Game?
Yeah, Play the Game, Not Games.
And then you did the full length right after that.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm not sure how much time was between, like, the first record with Dave Marsh on drums and then when I started recording. But, you know, I was in the band, like, 2 years, give or take. And then, you know, we put out a 10-inch EP and an LP in that time. And also released a compilation, though, just for the States, that's Stick-to-itiveness.
Right, right.
The company in the States. But that was a compilation between the first album and Play the Game, Not Games. So that wasn't necessarily new stuff. But within a space of a couple of years, we put on an album and an EP, which is a lot.
So was he just bringing in, like, songs? Like, he would just come in? Like, you said he was, like, the most talented guy, in your opinion. Like, he would just, every session, he would just bring in more and more songs that you guys would work with?
Well, no, really. We worked kind of in a very a methodical kind of way. Mm. Like, because it was like when I joined them, they were already, you know, known. You know, yeah. They had their first album out. It had been nominated for a Juno Award. It didn't win, but it was nominated.
Right.
So, you know, they were getting recognized. And it was, I remember the week I got the phone call from Matt to join the band. Then I remember going for lunch in this diner that was a block away from my house in Toronto, just after I talked with Matt about joining. And they were listening to the station, CHR, whatever it is in Toronto, and on the radio in the diner. And they played Karate Man. I'm like, oh, fuck, this is the band I'm in now. And I go, oh, Karate Man, it's not a bad song, you know? And because I had heard them before, but I didn't think I heard Karate Man, but that was the one that was getting played on the radio. And I said, oh, fuck, that's the band I'm in now, so not too bad, you know? But, yeah, and then I went out, and we just basically had to go on tour. So we were, like, busy the whole time I was in the band. It was like, if we weren't on tour, we were doing some recording somewhere. Like some of the Play the Game Not Games we recorded in Boston when we were at MIT at the radio station there. There's a couple cuts we recorded off there, and the rest was in Toronto at a friend's studio, Brendan McGuire. And so we were always busy. And if we weren't recording, we were making a video, or you know what I mean? We made a whole bunch of videos too. And or recording, playing, or touring, and then the band was over. You know, it seemed like a long time when you were in the middle of it, and we did a lot of stuff. But at the same time, it was only a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, and then you know, kabang, and you know, Matt Murphy pulled the plug. But no, fuck, I really can't say anything bad about those guys. Like, you know, and they were pretty tame. You know, for you know, rock and roll kind of standards, they were nice guys. You know what I mean?
Right.
They drank a little, and I mean, I was the guy who brought the weed into the band, and I always found that Charles, he'd have a puff with me more often than the other two guys, and then Drew, not as much as Charles, but Matt really never would. Matt, I think, maybe once or twice, never when we had to play, and none of those guys when we had to do a gig. And to me, it's just kind of funny because I smoke every day. I'm not no pot warrior. I'm not advocating for anything, but it's just part of my life now. But I remember I used to laugh because the Super Friends, we used to play like two shows in every city. Every city we played, we'd do an all-ages show in the afternoon
nice.
And then a grown-up show at night, every place.
Nice.
And I quite enjoyed that because I could play all day. And, you know, when you only play for an hour, you know, sometimes it just seems like you're just getting warmed up and you go off and it's over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
After an hour, you could play longer. But an hour Super Friends set is a good workout. And but I remember we used to put all these these all-ages shows. So it's like young kids, you know. And I was a few years older than the rest of the guys in the band. And like I said, I brought a lot of experience with me in different ways. And, you know, I remember when I first joined, you know, Colin McKenzie, you know, the manager, he told me, he goes, oh, yeah, you really, you make the Super Friends a little more punk. I said, yeah, whatever, you know, I'm a little rougher around the edges than they are. And so I brought that. I just remember, like, because, you know, you'd play these all-ages shows. And really, I love all-ages shows, man. I love turning young kids onto rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And but I always used to get a laugh because, you know, there's things like, you know, I remember, you know, I had this T-shirt. And it was a joke T-shirt I bought in Las Vegas, and it's like it says, you know those shirts that say "Property of
right,
New York Jets." This said "Property of Mabel's Whorehouse," and then on the bottom of the front it said, "Where the customer always comes first."
Nice.
And it's a joke T-shirt.
Right, right.
But I just remember being like in London, Ontario, and I was setting up my drums for this all ages show. And it was like, where we were, it was like a community hall or something. So we were on the floor. There was no stage. And kids were all standing pretty close around. You know, real rock and roll. That's what I like it. And so I remember, like, I was putting my bass pedal on the thing, and I was bending over or something like that. And then I stood up. And I stood up, and then within, like, 5 feet away from me were these two, they got to be 14 or 15-year-old, you know, young Asian girls that were there to see the Super Friends, and they were looking at my shirt, and they were shocked. Their mouths were open, and they were just like, they were shocked. And I just kind of had to laugh. I didn't say anything. It's just like, kids, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
I think the word whore
that's what did
freaked
it.
Them out. And then things like at all these all ages shows, there was times when we were playing, like on stage, and I would start laughing because I'd come to the realization, and this is how much time you have to think when you're back at the drums, right? I come to the realization that I'm at a rock show. There's like 300 kids here. I'm in the band, and I'm the only one in the entire building that's high. And so I'd think about that, and I'd just start laughing sometimes. And there was times on stage where I'd almost like lose the song on drums because I was laughing so hard at the absurdity of a rock show where no one's high. I mean, I'm not advocating for drug use, and I'm realistic enough to realize you don't need drugs to enjoy music.
Right.
But there's a certain part of me. I'm of an age where I grew up where rock and roll has to have a certain amount of distrust for authority and attitude and rebellion with it to be authentic, to move me. And you don't see that a lot anymore. And I kind of have a little bit of that in my DNA. So that's why I have all these experiences.
The Super Friends, though, you said it was so busy for like 2 years that you were with them, and then all of a sudden it was just over. Do you remember that conversation when Matt came in and said, we're just stopping?
Oh, yeah. No, I remember it. It wasn't really a conversation. He phoned. Like, I was in Toronto, and those guys still lived in Halifax.
Oh, okay.
And, like, I had never really permanently lived in Halifax. I'd stayed there for lengths of time while I was, you know, rehearsing or being there, but I would just always stay with Drew or Charles at their place. I never actually had a permanent residence that I paid rent there. I always lived in Toronto. So, yeah, I remember we came back from that last tour, and I didn't even know. It wasn't like, you know, when we were together that, you know, we talked about it. It was just like, I remember we played in the States. We were down in America, and the last gig we played was in Boston at the Middle East.
Hmm.
So and I remember driving back and went back to Halifax. And like I said, you know, we were always friends. Those guys are nice guys. They're not a-holes. They have no attitude. They're just nice people. And went back to Halifax, and as like they always did, all three of them in the band van, they drove me to the airport in Halifax, and we all said goodbye and said, we'll see you later. And we were going to make a video, I remember. We had just got a grant to make a video, and that was the next thing we were going to do, but they dropped me off at the airport. Just like nothing was saying, see you later, blah, 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 see you, blah, 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 go back to Toronto. And then I don't know how many, a week later, 2 weeks later, I get a phone call at home. And, you know, the girlfriend gives me the phone. Oh, it's Matt. I said, hey, Matt, what's going on? And like I said earlier, the Super Friends, they were very, they're just nice guys.
Mm-hmm.
They're not big, tough guys or anything. They got no attitude. And they... they're very non-confrontational, and there was a couple times, I think Matt was a little weary of me. He was a little, because I yelled at him a couple of times in the course when I was in the band, and he deserved it once. And I could tell you that story if you want, but
yeah,
I'll finish this one.
Yeah, no, what precipitated the yelling?
Well, let me finish this one first.
Sure,
about
yeah,
the breakup thing.
To,
well,
yeah.
He just, like, he phones me in Toronto. Like I said, nothing was said, and you know, I know this was all going on in his head before, but he never said anything to anyone. And hey, Matt, what's going on? And all he said to me was like, I'm quitting the band, and I'm buying the van.
Huh.
And I just went, oh, okay. And my head was just like, whoo, just spinning. I just said, oh, okay, cool. And then I hung up. You know, he didn't really talk because I know he was very uncomfortable, and I was just so flabbergasted. Or I don't know what the word is, just taken aback. I was, what the fuck? Like, what? So I hung up, and I immediately phoned Colin, the manager. I said, Colin, like, you know, I fucking composed my, what the fuck is going on? And he goes, I don't know, blah, 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 Matt, just quit the band and blah, blah, blah. So whatever, you know what I mean? And this wasn't my first rodeo, so, you know, I did get depressed. It was too bad. It was over. But I'd been through this before. I said, oh, well, there's another one,
yeah.
You know? But so what happened was, the bummer kind of part of it was that I remember talking to Colin, the manager, and we had just gotten a factor grant to make a video. And what Colin said to me, he goes, yeah, okay, well, you just can't tell anyone we're broken up yet because I want to collect some money first from this grant so we can make this video and a couple other people that kind of owed the band money. And if we tell them we broke up now, we might not get this money. So he goes, you got to be quiet. So for like 4 months, I had to live in Toronto, you know, going about my day. And go everywhere I went, people, hey, what's going on? Super Friends, you're going to play soon, blah, blah, blah. And it was just like, and I couldn't say anything to anyone that the band was over. And it was just like, and it got to a point, because, you know, that people were asking me every day, and it was kind of getting depressing that I couldn't, I felt like an asshole that I couldn't tell my friends the truth, you like, and I had to bullshit. And I phoned Colin one day, and I said, Colin, because I don't give a shit about anything. I'm telling people, I can't fucking walk around like this anymore. So I just, you know, it's not that I went on much music or anything, but you know, if people asked, I would just tell them, you know. So that's kind of what happened there. And then people kind of got really mad at Matt Murphy for a while for pulling the rug out. I know Colin was pissed off, you know, and I'm sure Charles was a little pissed off too, because, you know, I remember Matt saying that later that I want to do these other things. And I said, well, man, but you could do both. You could put out a fucking solo record. You could play in another band. Like, why can't you do both? You know what I mean? Like, you're throwing away such an opportunity. You know what I mean? And, you know, that's what I said to these guys. I said, man, like, you know, this is a really good opportunity for all of us. We were making money. You know what I mean? Like, we'd get money, a big chunk of money at the end of a tour given to us. You know? And at the end of a year, we get a bonus. You know, I'm not saying it was, like, anything great, but man, like, I've been in a lot of other bands that didn't even get anything like that, you know?
Exactly.
So I just said to them, I said, man, you know, you guys are throwing away a pretty good opportunity here, you know, whatever. And that's what happened with that. And what ended up happening, Matt said he was going to buy the band van, and he went on to form the Flashing Lights, and they used that van. But what had happened was that he never paid for it for years after. And like I said, those guys were such nice guys. And Drew Yamada, he's still one of my best friends to this day. I still speak with him all the time, as well as Charles. He felt so bad that time, and he's a nice guy. So he gave me my share of the money from the van, even though Matt had not actually paid the band for it yet. Because Drew, just, he felt bad for me, whatever. He said, he gave me my share. So I went away. But then it was like years later. It was like at least 4 years later. I remember there was Flashing Lights, and that they were using our old van because it was Matt's. And Steve Pitkin was the drummer for Flashing Lights. And I remember he was doing sound at the Cameron House one night, and I was playing there, and I was just talking with him. And this is when Flashing Lights were still touring. And I told him that story that I'm telling you about the van, that Matt still owed money on it to the Super Friends. And Steve got really mad. He goes, really? he goes, Matt still owes money for that? So then, like a month later, I hear from Drew that Matt coughed up the money to the rest of the guys and finally paid for the van that he'd been using for years on tour already, because they were probably thinking about selling it or something already. So it's funny how things work out.
Yeah, exactly.
But what was that other thing you wanted me to go back to?
You said you yelled at Matt Murphy a couple times, and he said
there was one time that I know it kind of made him, he was a little weary of me. Because I'm one of those guys that I speak my mind, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what happened was that I was in Toronto, and I used to have, at that point in time, I had my drums in Halifax in the Super Friends rehearsal space, but I was in Toronto. And I remember we were rehearsing, and then I went back to Toronto for a while, and then those guys were going to come in a couple weeks in the van with the gear, and we were going to go on tour, and they were going to pick me up. So, and I remember just before I was leaving, And Matt said, he goes, yeah, can I borrow some of your drum gear? I just want to jam with some people. I said, yeah, no problem. So a couple weeks later, we're in the van. These guys picked me up in Toronto. Our first gig was Regina. So we had to drive for like a day and a half or whatever for the first gig. And we get there, and we're the headline band. I open my drum stuff up, and there's like two cymbal stands, my snare drum stand, and something else, apart from a hi-hat, like missing, like not there. Like Matt borrowed this stuff and didn't put it back. So, and I got to preface all this with the fact that, like, I'm a professional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To me, I had to go to the opening band, to this kid, whose band, he's a teenager, whose band was opening for the Super Friends, and I had to borrow gear from him that night. And I was fucking pissed that I had to do that. Because I shouldn't have to.
No.
I'm in the fucking headline band. I shouldn't have to be borrowing stuff. But Matt lent out my stuff and didn't put it back and forgot. So I unpacked my shit and it was missing. And I was inside. Matt was outside in the parking lot. He was talking to some people, some kids that were fans. He was holding court, and I was livid. I just went out there and went, what the fuck? Jesus fucking Christ, Matt Murphy, I just fuck, blah, 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 blah. Tore a strip right off and right in front of these people. And he didn't really say much because, like I said, he was very non-confrontational. And like I said, I say all this, and I love the guy. I got nothing against Matt. And so whatever, you know, the gig went on. And we were riding in the van, and it must have been a couple days later. And I remember Drew was driving, I was in the passenger seat, and Charles and Matt were in the back. And Charles, we were just talking. And I don't know if you ever saw the Super Friends. Matt, you know, he'd always jump up on the drums and jump off. That he used to do that a lot, jump up on the bass drum and jump off and, you know, make it look good. And that was one of his things. And I remember that was the tour, that was the first tour that I brought my own drums. I did two or three tours before that, but they had a Super Friends drum kit that we used to use that was really good. You didn't even have to pack it up. You just picked it up. And because it was like really old and it didn't matter if it got beat up, but it sounded really good and it was easy to haul. So we used that for about a year. And then this was the first tour where we got serious. I said, I'll bring my drums, my real drums. You know what I mean? And so I remember riding in the van, and this was after the altercation in the parking lot, and we were riding in the van, and Charles asks me, he goes, hey, you know, he goes, you got your drums now. He goes, what are you going to do if Matt jumps up on your drums? And he was referring to my Canwood set, right? And, and I was in the front seat, and I don't know, I didn't do it on purpose or anything, but I just turned around and I looked over my sunglasses at Matt, and I said, well, Matt Murphy isn't in my good books right now, so he better just watch himself. And then I just turned around. And Drew, who was driving, he kind of went, he kind of stifled a fucking laugh. And then it was like silent for about 2 hours. And I mean, I wasn't trying to threaten the guy or anything, you know what I mean? And I've apologized to him for all that stuff since, right? But he was a little weary of me ever since then. And, you know, things like that were, you know, because I used to speak my mind, and those guys weren't like that. And that's why, you know, I came off a little bit rough for them sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what are you going to do? You know what I mean? You're in a van with people.
Yeah, things
happen. Things get testy, you know. It's a strenuous life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then Super Friends were in the van a lot. And I found with the Super Friends, touring with them was quite often with a full van. Like, there wasn't very often. It was just the four of us. We were quite often bringing another band with us to open. Like, we hauled the local rabbits around, like, in our van, two bands in a van, you know, all across Canada, you know. And, you know, I was the kind of guy who I like my routine.
Yeah.
So my routine, say, with the Super Friends on tour was, you know, like I said before, touring is not glamorous. People think you go on tour and you're in a band and you, like, it's all whatever, but what it is you get back to your shitty hotel room where like four guys got to stay in one room, you know, at 3 a.m. You've got to get up at 9 to drive to the next frickin' city because it's so far away. So you get no sleep. in this hotel room that you paid for.
Yeah.
You get in a van and ride all day. You go to a gig. You wait around. You do a sound check. And you wait like 4 more hours till midnight or 1 till you play. And then you go back at 3 in the morning to your hotel again. And it's rinse and repeat. Like every day forever. You know? And that's, it's kind of tedious and it's boring and it's really tiring and it's hard work. You know? And you've got to be into it.
What was the video that the Super Friends were going to make? For what song?
Oh, yeah, no, we did make it.
We
were broken up at that point, and it was for one of the songs off Slideshow. I don't know, we're doing some stuff, we're playing, and then those three guys go out on a boat, out on the water, and they're cruising around in a speedboat. I didn't go out in the boat because I'm afraid of water,
uh-huh.
And that was kind of like fitting because it's in the video.
Yeah.
That they're leaving on the boat and I'm waving goodbye to them. But at that point, we'd already broken up. I remember that. And we just did it because we had already gotten the money for the video. And we actually got paid, the three of us, a little bit of money, too, for making the video. So we just held our noses and then made the video. And that was still in the period where we weren't supposed to tell anyone we were already broken up.
Right, right.
But video was fun, I think. I remember. I just remember... not much about it, except we were outside for a lot of it, having to play, you know, lip sync, but playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember the video director asking me to take my sunglasses off, and I just said no. And that kind of like bummed everybody out for about 5 minutes. But it was like really bright out, and my eyes are really sensitive, and the band wasn't even together anymore, so I didn't feel the need to fucking bend for any of this. You know what I mean?
So how long after the demise, of, I guess, of the Super Friends did the Dio solo record come to be in 1999? The deal has Glenn Milcham on it, Jose Contreras, John Bora. It's loaded with talent. You really hear the growth, I think. I do, anyways, between This Land Is Your Land, and then which came out previously to Dio, and then Dio, which, I hear growth in the songwriting and you as a performer. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how you got the Dio kind of lineup together and writing those songs and putting together that solo album in 99.
It started like with the first record. That's, you know, I knew Jose from around the scene, and he helped me with the first record, and so naturally I asked him to come along and play on the second, and the second one was more of a bigger deal, like Mark and Phil from Teenage USA, who put out both those records. They got a grant or something, so they said like we're going to go. Like the first record was done like on a four track at home. It's more of a home job, and to mix it and master it, we went into a real studio to make it sound like a professional record. And I just got lucky with that. Well, that was a funny thing. I'll tell you the story. Because I knew Mark and Phil just from, they lived down the street from me on Queen Street when I lived on top of Hacienda. And I used to see them all the time, and they had their little record label. And Super Friends had just broken up. And I had this stuff recorded, and I remember I was literally in the alleyway behind Hacienda working a shift, emptying the garbage, and Mark was walking down the alley, and I had the tape in my back pocket, and I just said, "Hey, Mark, here's my new demo. You know, I want to give it a listen." And he took it. He was my buddy. He said, "Yeah, listen to it." And then he came back a couple days later and goes, "Yeah, it sounds good, but," he goes, "we just can't put it out, man. We just don't have any money or anything like that." I said, "Yeah, no problem, man. I didn't expect anything." But then it was like a week later. I remember it being like Christmas Eve. It was about a week later. He phones me at home. I was at home and he phones me. He goes, "Lonnie," he goes, "I've been listening to this record again." He goes, "We got to put it out." And I said, "Sure, okay, great." So they changed their mind. And, you know, my music is like that. It doesn't necessarily hit everybody right away. It's more of a deeper listen where if you listen to it five or six times, you'll start to make sense and it'll come to, you'll start to like it, whatever. But so that's what happened there. And then you come to Dio. You know, we put out the first record, like I said, which was a pretty low-key affair. Mm-hmm. I had pretty much had it recorded even before they signed me. But Dio was more of a proper record. So I got Jose to help me with the songs. And when we went to record, I got my friend, like I said, these are just my friends. You know, Glenn Milcham lived around the corner from me. I used to see him every day on the street walking around with his kids and his family. And so I got him. And then John Bora, who was another friend of mine, who was like one of the best bass players in town and a totally solid guy. So it was an all-star lineup, but, you know, kind of not for me. You know what
right.
I mean? Like,
exactly.
They were just my buddies, you know. But I was extremely fortunate to have those guys. And, you know, the record was more of a full-on rock, big rock production record.
Yeah.
But the problem with that, like what happened with that was, like, you know, believe me, I like that record. And I like those songs. And, you know, one of the songs I was going to suggest for you for the three songs is a song off that record. But the thing is, the label, and even me in my own head, right at that point in time, you know, I kind of had, you know, big rock dreams because I put out the big rock record and I had a little band together that wasn't those guys on the record. But Jose did a good few gigs of me. All the record release shows he played, but the other ones I had other guys and I had a different band. And it took me a couple years, you know, after the fact to figure out why, in the end, that project didn't work, was that I'm not really a rock guy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was trying to be like, you know, a Dave Grohl, you know, drummer that comes out and he's got this big rock band. And I tried that for a couple of years and I put out Dio, and that's a great record. But live, I couldn't really get a band that could do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm saying just as much that's my fault, too, that I realized that I'm not a rock guy. And so the big picture in my retrospect after going, why did after two albums my career kind of fizzle out like that? It was because I was trying to kind of put a square peg in a round hole. Because now, I'm more of a sensitive kind of songwriter guy. That's the side of me I should have been pushing back then. But, you know, the label, and even in my head at the time, was thinking rock. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, because these are just things I think about in retrospect.
Right.
You know, why did this happen? Why did this go this way? And why did not that happen? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's why I probably didn't put out a third record for a long time, was because I figured out that I wasn't a rock guy. And now I'm more of a folk rock kind of a guy, and that suits me more. And when I play live now with my stuff, it's like me on acoustic guitar, I have another woman that sings duet with me, and there's a piano player, and that's how I play my songs now, and that's the best format for those songs as opposed to a rock band. So it took me a while to figure out that I wasn't a rock guy. I had to put out a few rock records first and hit my head against the wall and try to figure out why it wasn't working for a while before I came to the realization that I'm not a rock guy, even though I am a rock guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that my favorite track off the new record is Once in a While.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good record, man.
But there's actually one song from the 90s from your solo work that I'd like people to hear. If you remember writing it or recording it, Piano in the Sand, I'm a huge fan of. Can you give me kind of a background on that track, a deep dive?
Oh, yeah, no, that's pretty cool. I don't necessarily know about recording and stuff, but like the idea of that song is like, I don't know if you're a Beach Boys fan at all.
I am, yeah, yeah.
Or belong to the cult of Brian Wilson. I'm a card-carrying member. So if you know that much, then maybe you know the legend of him, that he actually at one point was so far into drugs and his mania and his songwriting that he felt that he had the only way to write authentic Beach Boys songs was to have a big pile of sand in his living room and his piano was on it.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that's how he would write songs. He had a huge pile of sand brought into his living room in his mansion in Bel Air or whatever. And he literally would, because he said he wanted to write songs with his feet in the sand. So he literally had his piano in the sand. And that's where the idea for that song is. And it's kind of a, it's just me giving a wink to Brian Wilson. Like, if you read the lyrics, it's not about the Beach Boys, but it references them kind of in an obtuse kind of way.
Right.
So that's what it's centered around.
Interesting.
it's kind of my saying, hey, I love you, Brian Wilson. Thanks for everything, you know.
Some fun in the warmth of the sun. You're so good to me. I get around feeling the sound. Your white shoes next to me. Busy doing nothing here today. You said we should go away. God only knows I never wanted to go from the sand. Cast me by the sea. So nice, you're with me tonight. Let's go away for a while. We sailed on together, then you drifted away. We left our songs in the sand.
You're back now with a new record. Can you talk a little about the songs on that album? And, you know, because almost every song is almost a duet in a way.
Yeah, it is. That's a good observation because that's what I'm into now. Like I love like X. You ever heard the band X with Xene and John Doe?
For sure, yeah.
Or the Everly Brothers. All that stuff blows my mind because where I'm at now as a songwriter and a musician is the power of voice. Mm. Like the human voice is so powerful. It's more powerful than the loudest guitar amp you can buy. Because it affects people, it can reach deep down inside of you, and squeeze your heart if it's used properly. So that's what I'm into now. That's why, like I said, when I play now, it's me on a guitar, and I sing. I have my partner Kayla singing a duet, and a buddy on piano, and that's how I play now. It's easy to gig. You make more money than a full band, and if I ever get a chance to go on a big tour or play on huge stages, I'll get a full band. But for now, this works.
Nice.
But because I'm a rock guy. I've been in rock bands my whole life, and all we've been talking about all day so far here is rock music.
Right.
And you know, this is all still in the scope of rock music, but I'm just. Where, like I said, the new music for me is now, like I said, voices, man, and the power in quiet and silence and space. And, you know, at the risk of sounding crazy, I learned a lot about the power of space from Thelonious Monk, the jazz piano guy.
Right.
Where, you know, he leaves a lot of space in his music, and it made me realize, because I love his music, he's one of the greatest composers of all time, if you ask me. The space he leaves in his music is just as powerful as the notes he plays, and I learned that, and I said, this is what I apply to what I do now, is I concentrate on the voices, and we live in a world that is just... Everything is overload. Everything is so loud. Advertising is just blasting into your head. Cars are going so fast. Like, everything is so intense that what I want to do is just say there's power in silence and there's power in stillness. So when I play live, that's kind of what it's about. It's not about being the loudest or the fastest or whatever. It's power in being still, kind of. So it's not what some people would call rock, but there's a lot of attitude behind it. It's just not presented in a rock format like guitar, bass, and drums.
And the theme lyrically is a lot about love, I found, by listening to the record.
That's exactly what the theme is for that record, and I've already started planning the next record, and it's not going to be about that.
Interesting.
That was kind of, I used that as a loose theme, both the positive and negative sides of love.
And where can people listen to the record, or where can they find it?
It came out just a couple weeks ago. It's on Bandcamp and Spotify and anywhere where anyone would stream music, or Bandcamp, where you can buy it. And anytime within the next few months, there's going to be vinyl too. It's at the pressing plant.
Nice.
Every record pressing plant right now in Canada is so behind because they're so backed up. So it could take a couple more months, but vinyl is on the way.
Awesome.
The deposit has been paid. They have the files.
Nice.
I'm just waiting for the test pressings to show up. And I cannot wait to put one of my own records on the turntable.
Yeah, for sure. All right, cool. Any kind of final words before we get into the last question? Any kind of final words about your time in the 90s in Canada?
The 90s, man, were a really... It established, you know, Southern Ontario as a place of rock.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because Ontario is like the only province in Canada, unless someone can correct me, where you can do a tour. You know what I mean? A mid-level... indie band can, there's enough little cities that have enough clubs that can sustain you on a tour, you know, without having to play covers or be a country band, you know. So the 90s brought that about. So that's a good thing. And, you know, I mean, there's so many bands from Ontario, from all these small towns that eventually all migrate to Toronto because that is the center of the industry. So, yes, the 90s were a pretty cool time. And I come back to this theme of being very fortunate. I feel very fortunate that I was kind of in the middle of all of it. I made a lot of good friends, and I saw a lot of amazing music being made and recorded and performed, and I was part of a lot of it too. So, so it's all good, man. There's hard to say anything bad, you know?
Exactly, yeah. All right, excellent. So final question. I have a playlist on Apple and Spotify of all 90s can rock. So I'm asking all the guests to pick two singles and one deep cut. So how would you like to be represented as far as the songs that you recorded in the 90s?
Okay, well, like I mentioned earlier, the two singles, I guess would say would be the one from Dio, For No Real Reason.
Okay.
And then Green Hand by the Super Friends.
Nice.
Which was off the Play the Game, Not Games.
Yeah.
Those would be the two singles. And then the deep cut would be Catwalk Slip by The Lawn.
Ah, awesome.
Off W.C. Fields.
Perfect. Well, excellent choices, sir. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today on the podcast and talk about your experience in the 90s, man. It's been fantastic.
Hey, no problem. Tyler, man, you're doing a great service for everybody. And, you know, this up there is something that people can keep coming back for years down the road to reference and learn stuff from. So keep it up, man.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Raven Drool. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can do so in a variety of ways. First, you can go to patreon.com/ravedrool, become a patron, get access to deleted audio, get advance notice of the guests, and get a chance to submit questions to those guests for an exclusive Patreon Q&A. Visit redbubble.com, search Rave Drool, and you can buy various goods with the Raven Drool podcast logo on it. Follow or subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to this. And if you listen to this on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating and review. If you're looking for more 90s Karen Rock content, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. And lastly, if you're looking for music, we have an official playlist on Apple and Spotify. Currently, it's curated by myself, the tracks that I've selected, but as you heard during today's episode, eventually, it'll be curated by the guests themselves. Until next time, friends, take care.